Accession number 11512, Reel 4.
Major Watson, Reel 4.
Yeah, I think we basically had to ignore minefields because clearly in a situation like this there's not time to bother about things like that that are going to impede the advance, even if treading on them is going to kill or wound. My own particular task, as explained, was to make sure that we were following the correct direction and we were going at the correct speed. And I was using a prismatic compass, which I was holding in my left hand in front of me, in front of my stomach, and looking down to make sure we were keeping the correct bearing. And suddenly there was a clang. There were millions of clangs, but there was my own personal clang, I think, and the prismatic compass swung, it was on a tape round my neck, swung right round my neck, and I thought, what's happened? And looked down, and a shell splinter or something had gone right into my hand, and I suppose a bit of it must have gone and hit the prismatic compass, and they swiveled it right round my neck. It was just as well that the metal of the compass was there. Or, as happened to many another poor fellow, I would have had a shell splinter or whatever right in my belly. At what particular moment this was, I can't recall, but the advance, I forget whether it had stopped or not, but I went back to the RAP, the Regimental Aid Post, which was, say, a few, 100 yards or whatever behind. It was certainly between the two forward companies and behind us. And they had got themselves a big shell hole in the ground by this time, and there was old Doc McGowan administering medical treatment as best he could in a most cool, calm and collected way. I don't know what I was. I was in a semi kind of, not giggly stage, but to me it wasn't really happening. And the doctor said, what's wrong? He said, "Oh, I've been wounded." So he bound my hand round, and after saying a few things, I went back to where battalion headquarters was. But this time they had brought in another officer into the navigating party. I think that night, I don't recall as many, but I think there were four or five called to assist in the navigation. And we proceeded forward again. And the whole thing, it was very real, but somehow it was a bit unreal, which I suppose is a saving grace in a situation like that. And again, the results of training. You kept going. Came the time, I think there was a period when our advance had been slightly quicker than it should have been. And I think, but this really should be verified somewhere, but we may have got mixed up with, apart from the German firing, the back end, as it were, of our own artillery, but I'm not really clear on this. But we had to lay down for a period, as it were, to adjust the time and the pacing. On this occasion, as on several during that night, I remember James Oliver, our commanding officer, a rifle slung over his shoulder, wandering around as cool and calmly as if he were in his solicitor's office in Arbroath. A remarkable fellow. absolutely outstanding. Of course, a lot of people by this time had been killed and wounded. And obviously, this was going to continue to happen, but you realized, well, you didn't realize it then, you just, I suppose, in a way, realized that what was happening to you and what you were doing. But neither side of your jocks were going forward with their bayonets on their rifles. And not, some outposts were met, some Germans were killed and encountered, taken prisoner and sent back. But it was a long, hard, steady slog under a rain of shells and machine gun bullets and mines going up. And how do men do such things? Goodness knows. Anyhow, came the time when when we had to make some adjustment in the time and the pacing. I was lying down on the ground. Next to me was George Morrison. I'm not sure whether Ian Foggy. George was one of our company platoon commanders from Crieff. Ian Foggy was, I think he was then signals officer from Dundee. But all of a sudden, George just gave a whoop, and I looked at him, and George was dead. How? I don't know. I don't remember seeing any evidence of blood or anything on his body, but George had copped it. But in a way, that was what happened. George had copped it, and up you went, and on you went. Oh yes, I think maybe about the same time, I got a lot of shell splinter, they must have been small, in my backside. So my khaki shorts, we of course were in shorts now, and because no officers were in kilts, that had been stopped because they stuck out like a sore thumb, and Germans could pick them off. Except, I think, for old Rab Kelty. Old Rab insisted he would never take his kilt off. But I think all the rest of us were certainly in shorts. And it was dripping blood. But that wasn't... that was a flea bite, really, compared with what was happening elsewhere. But I don't think you even thought about it in these terms. You got on with the job. And on we went. Now, subsequently, others in the what was known as the Compass Party were killed or wounded, and Ian Foggy among them, that's right, he was wounded at some stage, I forget which one, because we were all kind of fairly close, but I can't remember the others who were wounded in the Compass Party. My own eye section, I can't remember even how they fared. Isn't it incredible? I subsequently got a shell splinter in my nose. And so the night wore on. How long it went on, God knows, but I suppose if it started at 10 o'clock, it must have gone on till... Again, history books will tell.
So this is the 24th of October?
Yeah. In the early morning, it must have gone on till 4 or 5 o'clock. Anyhow, Come First Light found us well into, well across no man's land, through all the minefields and what have you, into the German positions, with some objectives reached, others still to be gained. Again, history books will give the detail. And set to dig as best we could, slit trenches, hence the shovels and picks we'd carry with us, against the inevitable counterattack that we knew would come. I found it a bit difficult to the hand bandage to dig a slit trench, but eventually we managed to. And then the day wore on, and the positions that we hadn't taken, the companies had to move forward and take, and the Germans counterattacked. But then the CEO said to me, he said, "Peter, you ain't going back." Well, I had no desire to go back, but I suppose I must have looked a sorry sight. Anyhow, the Ren gun carriers were being used to take the wounded back. So I was put on a Bren gun carrier and taken back to a forward dressing station, I suppose it was. It's strange, really, how it can affect you now in a way almost more than it affected you then. Because the last thing I wanted to do was to be sent back, or at least told to go back. Anyhow, back I went. On the what I suppose by this time was this, where the start that had been, etc., who do I come across but John Hopwood, Laughing John. John was a regular officer, but was second in command of the 7th Battalion Black Watch, which was a territorial battalion. And he was LOB, which was left out of battle. In other words, a certain proportion of officers and jocks were kept out of battle to be immediate reinforcements for during or after a battle to replace casualties, etc. And John and I had what might almost be described as a social conversation about how's it going out there, Peter? Ha ha ha. Quite incredible. How do men do such things? I don't know. Anyhow, that, unfortunately, was the end of my participation in the Battle of Alamein, because from the, what do they call it? Forward dressing station or something, I was sent to hospital in, I think it was Cassassin, where I was operated on. And then, because they need to keep the more forward hospitals as clear as possible, because of the casualties anticipated as the fighting went on, I was sent by rail through the Gaza Strip to Jerusalem. And I had another operation there. on my arm and my nose. They didn't do anything about my bottom. They said, if we take the bother bits out, you'll have no bottom left. So they presumably are still around somewhere. But it's incredible when you think of the experiences that people had and the suffering they underwent. I really didn't suffer to that extent. I mean, I could have been much worse. But Chats had stomach blown out, head blown off, killed, legs, arm. You're really listening to somebody whose wounds were very light, who went through the same kind of situation where men were killed and had bits of them blown off. It's luck, absolutely. It must be true what they say, if your number's on it. Anyhow, I spent, I don't know, in Jerusalem, which was a pleasant experience, really, but nothing to do with the war. Left Jerusalem, I think sometime in December, early December. Went to, back to Egypt, where they had, I think they call it a rehabilitation unit or something. Oh yes, via Nathania, where I spent 5 or 6 days in a convalescent depot and got cheesed off with it completely. I wanted to leave there as soon as I could. Got back to the, where was it, Casasino, Katap or somewhere, where they had a rehabilitation to make sure you were fit again to get back to the, back to your unit. Where those who were there will remember the big flea and the little flea, which were large hills made out of empty petrol cans filled with sand. And the army had conceived the delightful idea of having you jump off the little flea several times to make sure your ankles or your legs were all right. And then you went to the big flea, which was a horrendous jump. This was their way of working out that you were all right to go back to unit. Anyhow, after a few days there, if you belong to a unit like the 7th Battalion, any good unit, the last thing you want to do is not to be with them. And you just want to get back. So I ignored the, as some others did, army rules and regulations, and tucked myself onto a plane. Because by this time, the advance, the Battle of Alamein had finished, and you'll have to refer to history books or other experiences to see the awesome things that went on during the 12 days fighting, and it must really have been a tough slog in that open, exposed ground. But the battalion had got near to a place called Mersa El Brega in Libya. So this plane, I got off this plane somewhere near Benghazi and then went by truck. Nobody knew where the unit was, but, and I forget how I found out, but eventually got back to the unit at Mersa El Brega. And it was like coming home again, wasn't it? Subsequent to that, we had a slight battle at Mersa El Brega, which was a strange position that the Germans had occupied on the coastal road. But I seem to recall a battalion advance in trucks over open ground where we came across mines that had been planted indiscriminately, and there was no minefield or anything like that. The buggers had just put them down anywhere. We lost one or two trucks and men being blown up on them. We finally made an attack on Mersa Brega, a night attack, which was a bit confusing, as I recall. But by the time we... I'm a bit kind of confused about this, but the Germans appeared to withdraw with some rapidity from that position. And we proceeded then westward in the desert. And even I, with my memory, have to refer to my notes. Where did we get to then?
Buerats?
Oh, yes. We went through Buerat. I think one mentions names just here because until you get to specific battles, because we were then in the van of the 8th Army, and our job really was to harass and pursue the enemy, which was now largely Germans, because, as you recall from other readings that you may have done, the Italians had given up in droves and thousands and hundreds of thousands. The sight was remarkable at Alamein and subsequently. And we came to, again, to Misurata and Slitten and Homs. I shall never forget Homs, because outside Homs, this was fairly near the coast, there was a place called Corradini. And Homs was a difficult place to be in because there was constant German shelling. And it wasn't indiscriminate. I suppose we were indiscriminate in being in the places that the shells were falling, but you never seemed to be out of the danger of shell landing somewhere about. And this was on the coast, and the Corradini feature, which became known as Edinburgh Castle, was a very dominant mountain which overlooked the whole area, and Homs, of course, was right in the sight of all the gunners. I remember we captured a German machine gunner, and being able to speak some German, we were anxious to find out what the armaments were in Corradini. I can't recall how much of a balls that I made of that interrogation. I must have found something out, but one shouldn't really in the front line interrogate prisoners. But the decision was then taken that Corradini had to be, and the position behind Corradini, I'm a bit confused now, had to be taken. Anyhow, the idea was that the infantry would go around the coast, and between the coast and the road that led through Homs to Corradini, it was very kind of slopey, overgrown ground. A very difficult area to get through, and not a lot of time to do it. So it was decided that some tanks would come with us, and some of us would ride on the backs of these tanks, and we would go through this rough ground to get behind the German positions, which we duly did overnight. I almost partially disgraced myself, I remember, but riding on the back of one of the tanks and being so exhausted, I fell asleep, and I almost missed the battalion getting off the tanks and forming up and going towards the Corradini position. We came into sight of the Corradini position somewhat late in the open, and it was a defile dominated on one side by German positions. And as we advanced what was the forward slope down the side of this defile, all hell was let loose, and we got quite a stonking from the German artillery and the machine guns. We could see the Germans in the distance getting ready apparently to withdraw, and Sergeant Hunter of the Pioneer platoon did a remarkably brave thing. He crawled down to a bridge that carried the road over a small wadi, and he deloused the dynamite, whatever, that had been put under the bridge to blow it up. He then crawled back, and I got a feeling that he was either killed or captured But the Germans somehow managed to reinstate the explosive stuff. I think that is too where Robin County led a bayonet charge on some German positions in his kilt, as usual. Robin, I think, was wounded and taken prisoner. Some of the jocks were taken prisoner. It was a kind of untidy, nasty situation. At one stage, there was a mortar that was troubling us, coming from our right flank. And I took some jocks and crawled up this forward slope with the object of getting behind this mortar and trying to knock it out. And we got above the position. We had a Bren gun with us. We settled the Bren gun down to fire on the position, when all of a sudden they started lobbing their mortars over in our direction. Now, this is one situation where I've always felt that I should have pressed forward with more resolve than I showed then, and not, as I did, withdrawn from that position without really trying to, with the use of the Bren gun and a rifle fire, root the Germans out. But then everyone, I suppose, has thoughts like that afterwards. But the effect was that, realizing that there were now, because we had got behind the line in this situation, realizing that there were apparently British troops behind them, the Germans withdrew from their positions, and we then were able to move forward to eventually, after details of where we were and what rest days we may have had, I cannot recall, would have to come out of battalion history books. But we finally got, oh yes, I remember at Corradini, yeah, we were told that unless we took Corradini, I remember it well now, standing on the side of the road, just during the course of the battle, we were told that unless we took Corradini, and therefore we would be able to go forward to Tripoli, because this was the last strong defensive position the Germans could have, the whole of the 8th Army, or the whole of the van of the 8th Army, as we were, would have to go back to Tripoli, because our supply line was so attenuated and stretched that they couldn't maintain a proper fighting unit so far away from Tripoli. We're heading towards Tripoli. So far away from Benghazi, that's right. And if you look at the map, you'll see that Benghazi is on the east side of the Gulf of Sirte, and the Gulf then snakes down south and then goes west towards Tripoli. And Corradini, I suppose, is maybe, 10, 15 miles, 20 miles from Tripoli. It was a question of so near and yet so far, but the supply line was so stretched that if Tripoli were not taken soon,